Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So here we are. What's new? Billie Eilish, what's going on, Mark? What's been happening the last week?
Billie Eilish, well, as far as I can see, she had to apologise yet again. Another person apologising. Oh, my God, I'm sick of it. I'm heartily sick of it. She apologised for mouthing a controversial word when she was 13. And she's 19 now, I think. So 6 years ago, somebody trawling through her, you know, social media back catalogue found a clip of her mouthing a controversial word, and she's had to apologise. And if you don't apologise 100% and look profusely apologetic,
yeah, you've got to haven't you?
Yeah, you have. You've got to literally thrash yourself with birch twigs.
I have let
you've got to parade
down
yourself through the streets, yes, throwing rotten fruit in your
woe
own face.
Thrice woe.
Because
I once did something when I was
13.
It doesn't look sincere either way, really, does it?
No, it doesn't.
You know, because it's so kind of overstated.
There's a PR standing out of the shop with a gun.
I mean, it made me think various things. Oh, we were talking about this the other day, you know.
Oh, should I just mention one more thing that her boyfriend has had to apologise? Did you find the story?
What, for being a boyfriend?
Reported boyfriend. So one of the people reporting this isn't even absolutely sure if this is her boyfriend, but her reported boyfriend, Matthew Tyler Vorse, has apologised for some controversial tweets he posted 9 years ago. Dave, this is her boyfriend. This is not the person making a video.
Not even 6 degrees of separation.
I know. So next you're going to people's sisters and their brothers and their parents and anyone they ever met who might have said, a taxi driver who once gave him a lift, who might have said something controversial. Oh, my God.
Here's my question to you. Has Mick Jagger ever apologised?
No, I don't think he has. I can't imagine him ever apologising.
I think that's a damn good precedent, actually.
Yeah, it is.
Because once you start, you never bloody stop, do you really?
Surely the brand of Mick Jagger would be incredibly tarnished by the fact that he had apologised.
I suppose.
The Stones don't say sorry. Keith Richards saying sorry for doing something. It's very unlikely. Oh, my God.
I tell you what it reminded me of. Back in the days of Smash Hits, we used to notice that an infallible index of how well your career was going is what would a playground rumor circulate to the effect that you were about to die. Because if that happened, that meant you were really happening. You were hot stuff, you know. So I can remember Boy George is about to die. Annie Lennox is about to die. Simon Le Bon is about to die, whatever. I mean, people would write to Smash Hits, so they'd ring up or whatever and ask.
I remember ringing up about David Sylvian, Weeping Girl.
Yeah. And all it was, I think, was playground squabbles about who's your favourite pop group. And the kind of rejoinder that people used to use was, well, he's about to die. So in those days, it was done person to person in a playground. Nowadays, if you want to, you know, bite back at anybody you don't like, you just go on social media, don't you?
You
convince yourself that in taking somebody down, you are simultaneously raising yourself. Raising yourself and somebody else.
It's not true
at all, you know.
No, not remotely.
And the other thing that struck me about this is, do you want your pop stars to be the people who did everything right when they were 13, 14, 15? Do you want them to be the 13, 14-year-olds that won the headmaster's prize for conduct? And, you know, do you really? Do you want them to be the head boy or head girl? I don't think you do you?
No, part
of the deal of being a pop star is that they kind of make mistakes. They do all sorts of things that you do, you know. And so the idea that she's having to apologize for something she did when she was 14 years old, which wasn't, as far as I can see, is not anything particularly particularly extreme anyway.
Nothing heinous.
Is just absolutely ridiculous.
But you're so right, because also if you want them to be maverick and controversial and original and idiosyncratic, you would expect them to have been like that all the way along. And if they weren't, then that would look like a kind of, it would appear artificial. They've somehow also made an effort to be.
But also, more to the point, grow the fuck up, because if you want them to be rebellious, they'll do some things that you don't approve of. That's the deal. Otherwise, they're just like you. What's the point of that, you know? So, I think everybody should just... Oh, sorry.
I couldn't agree more. Is it a terrible time to be a pop star?
Well, it's no time at all.
It's terrible, an appalling time, apart just from walking on eggshells.
Waiting to be torn down all the time.
Well, yeah, walking on eggshells. Not being able to live a particularly colourful life without being criticised. No music press to make you look more fabulous. But the thing that struck me the other day is the album tour cycle that used to be in place is gone now. And that used to mean that you could make your album, then you do your tour, and then you would legitimately disappear for a year, and no one would expect to hear from you. And then you go back to the farm and you drink a lot of beer and you lie around in a hammock and you behave badly or whatever. But now you don't get any time off. And so you've constantly got to fill that by reminding people that you're still around. I would hate that kind of pressure.
So rock stars are obviously doing puzzling things during the pandemic. Damon Albarn's got a mullet, is that right?
Oh, yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, he has. He's got a mullet.
Is it particularly extreme? I can't say I've seen
it. Not particularly extreme, but it's undeniably a mullet. It's caused a few ripples. And I thought, I was on the basis, I think the mullet is one of those things I never thought would come back, actually. Although it's faintly come back in rugby, am I right?
Oh, it very much come back in rugby.
Yeah.
Rugby forwards, all, if you want to be in the England front row, you've got to have a mullet nowadays.
Yeah.
It's supposed to make you look like an orc. You know, it's supposed
Oh, yeah, of course.
That's the whole deal, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it'd make it frightening.
A semi-mythical beast who's going to wreak terrible havoc upon you.
Yeah.
Is the kind of person who has a mullet. So I can't. Damon Albarn clearly not like that at all. You
what
know?
Did Magic Alex, our producer, how did he describe the mullet? Was it business at the front, party at the back? Was it something like that? It's really funny.
That's right.
I mean, various things can surely never come back. And I would say the 4-inch stack heel boot, a la Susie Quattro, can it come back? It came back with Lady Gaga, but as a kind of fashion.
It comes back as a joke, doesn't it?
As a joke. You know, snoods, the Nick Kershaw snood, I doubt it.
Oh, yeah, you're probably right.
No, the baggy 3/4-length trouser, as worn by, you know, the Tartan Lords, but at one stage worn by Paul McCartney. Do you remember that?
Oh, my God, he did.
Yeah, yeah, they call, I can't remember what they're called now. Clam kickers or something. I can't remember what it is. The one-piece zip-up jumpsuit, as worn by Todd Rundgren.
Todd Rundgren. And also Pete Townsend. Also,
yes, he did.
Although that was a boiler suit, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, it was a boiler suit.
Mick Jagger sported a one-piece jumpsuit during a tour in the mid-70s of the United States. And I think it's fair to say that there was no evidence of underwear.
as with Todd Rundgren, I can remember that.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Did you see which way he dressed?
You could. Yeah, you assess his religion, et cetera, et cetera. Dave Hill, the crescent moon fringe and the Baco foil cape, that can never come back. And nor, I think, the leopard skin bum flap. Do you remember that when we were in Smash Hits? Walking down Carnaby Street in 1980, the number of people who'd come to town just to buy a leopard skin bum flap, pretend to be a punk.
Or send off to the mail order advert.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
In Smash Hits.
In Smash Hits. And
get a mail order bum flap. A leopard skin bum flap, yes. No, there's no immediate sign of that stuff coming back. And and I'm quite relaxed about it. Let me just say. So is it right there's the 50-year anniversary of the Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore East?
It holds
up copy of Live at the Fillmore East. I should just point out this juncture.
Which I have too.
That if you were...
If
you're a Patreon supporter, you would not only be seeing Mark Allen and myself holding up our matching copies of Fillmore East, you know, you would see them as well as hear us talking about them because you'd be looking at this. So, you know, if you haven't become a Patreon supporter, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear. And we'll just wait while you do that. No, let's get on.
Can I just say, that is a fantastic album sleeve picture, don't you think?
Do you know where that was taken?
Yes, I do, actually. I think it was taken in Macon, Georgia. It wasn't taken at the Fillmore Regis. I think Jim Marshall just staged it against a brick wall.
It was their rehearsal place in Macon.
Yeah, it was. It was.
And then on the back, it's got the road crew.
The roadies.
Now, how many bands have, you know, a picture of the road crew on their album cover? Actually,
Pink Floyd's Umagumma. That's about it.
Pink Floyd's Umagumma, which is Naomi Watts' father, Peter Watts.
Yeah, that's right.
And also, have you noticed this?
The guy who was in jail or something.
I think he just couldn't make it to the photo session.
I'm not sure.
Anyway, he got it included in there on the kind of inset, which is.
But nice. If you look at I know this is ridiculous, but somebody who loves the Allman Brothers as much as me will have looked at the outtakes from that session, and they're all. If you ever seen them, they're all really quite serious. They're all sitting there, and they're kind of serious portraits, and they just don't work. And that picture is absolutely electrifying. I think as a kid, I just thought I really want to join this game.
It's because they're laughing.
Because they're laughing, and there are loads of sleeves, you know, which have got bands on the front, loads of Ramon sleeves and Clash and Stones, but they look a bit intimidating, actually, and a bit weird and a bit aggressive, and you don't particularly want to join the gang. There's a great XTC sleeve, the black sleeve, Black Sea.
Oh, yeah.
You kind of think that'd be fun to be a part of. There's
where they're wearing diving outfits, aren't they?
Yeah. Madness One Step Beyond, that's another one. You think that'd be a brilliant band to be in.
Yeah.
And Freewheeling Bob Dylan was the other one. Not that's a band. I remember looking at that and thinking, that is fantastic.
You know, see,
in that street with that jacket.
I've taken that picture. Have you ever seen the famous picture of, I think it's Charles and Di's wedding, isn't it? Where Patrick Litchfield, or whoever was the photographer taking the official snaps back at Buckingham Palace.
Yeah.
He rigged up an additional camera, which was just due to take a picture when everything stopped. And so the famous picture is of them all just laughing.
Oh, because the relief, because the session's just gone, over.
It's done.
Oh, that's
and
fantastic.
That's the picture. That's the picture that everybody remembers. I'm pretty sure it's at the wedding. It's certainly at some major royal occasion. And so, yeah, 50 years since the Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore, which is arguably the greatest live rock and roll album.
Right?
And, you know, we'll fight anybody who says different. I was listening to it only the other day, actually, because I've got this version that was put out for the, I can't remember which anniversary this was. It must have been 40 years ago that this came out, which is the full, all the concerts, all the sets that they did that week. And it's got the introduction to the final show, which is late on the last night. And by late, I mean something that started at 2:30 in the morning, I think. And it's introduced by Bill Graham. And it's coming to the end of the Fillmores, because that's the year he closed them, because Led Zeppelin and so forth were making it impossible for him to continue running it in the same way. And so he introduces them and pretty much says, of all the bands we've had here, and they had had everybody, this is the best, you know. And it's a fair point, actually.
Oh, it's an incredible record.
It's an extraordinary record.
Absolutely astonishing record.
So also 50 years ago this week, is it Joni Mitchell's Blue or something like that?
Yeah.
So Paul Kramer was telling me that it hasn't been in the chart, I think, since 1972 in the UK, which I suppose is not surprising at all. But it's currently sold so many downloads and physical copies in the last week because of the fuss about 50th anniversary that it's going to chart.
It's
kind of ridiculous. You still think, well, this record was there to buy 3 weeks ago or 6 weeks ago, 2 years ago or whatever. And people didn't do it, you know, whereas, you know, you got the fuss about an anniversary.
And it interested me that it's reached that kind of immortal plateau, hasn't it, Blue? And you could argue that there are other records that I think you prefer Courtney Spark. I mean, there just are other records of hers that are actually better, but it's just done it. And not every band has an equivalent of that. You think they would. There's various records that you can see the piece in the Times, you know, saying it's 50 years since Sgt. Pepper or Abbey Road or Pet Sounds or Dark Side of the Moon or Bridge Over Troubled Water or Transformer, you know what I mean? Songs in the Key of Life. I don't know what else. Joshua Tree, never mind. But there are other records that are kind of cultural milestones. They're not particularly great records, but it's however many years since Never Mind the Bollocks or the first Oasis record or Joy. But, you know, there is no equivalent for Bob Marley. There's no equivalent for Steely Dan. Is there? There's no record where you say this is 50 years or 40 years since. It's no Led Zeppelin record, no Who.
I think also the one of the reasons Blue is so celebrated is it's kind of it's become a kind of feminist tract, hasn't it? Latterly. Yeah. Never was back in the day at all. And so now it's kind of like a virago paperback, isn't it?
You know? It is.
And I think it's very often appreciated as such. I can't say I play it very often. Whereas, you know, like you were saying, I prefer Courtney Spark in the sense that I play Courtney Spark.
Well, Courtney Spark's got those upbeats. He's got Free Man in Paris.
It's a brilliant pop record. It's a fantastic pop
Raised
record.
On Robbery. I mean, those are amazing. I mean, Blue is it's got one tone, as indicated by the title, you know, which is rather somber and rather mournful and reflective tone. But it's incredibly attractive. I think it's an amazing record. Absolutely astonishing.
So we saw this thing this morning that Eamon Ford published on the Forbes website about a band called Salt, S-A-U-L-T, who've put out an album which will disappear after 99 days.
That's a good idea, isn't it?
I think it's a good
idea. Has anyone ever done that before? Because that presumably just accelerates your... I mean, I think you can download it free. Is that right? You can buy the hard copy for £20 or whatever. You can download it free. But if you don't get... I mean, it's just a really good way of reminding people that it's there. And it's not going to be there forever. And therefore, if you want to do something about it, you'll have to act now.
Yeah.
That was quite a clever publicity ruse.
Yeah, I don't know if it's more
than
make
any ruse. Make any copies of it that seem quite valuable. It's a great idea.
Well, because it's the obvious rejoinder to the thing that we're often saying on these podcasts, which is there's no hurry to listen to anything. Because it'll be there in 2 years' time. Whereas they're saying, no, it won't be there in 2 years' time. And I suppose it also... you know, is similar to what's going on in certain areas of social media with TikTok and things like this, which things that disappear after they've, you know, had their few minutes in the sun. That part of their appeal is they're not there for ages. They just go away. And you kind
of... It's the polar opposite of what U2 did, isn't it, really? Remember U2 put out their... What was it called? Songs of Innocence. I can remember suddenly finding it in my phone. They put out with Apple.
The worst idea.
They gave a free copy to anybody.
Has anybody?
Yeah.
Okay, this is a good question to put to the massive. Actually, we've all had a copy of that record. Has anybody ever listened to it? Because I haven't. Have you?
No, even if I'd wanted to listen to it, which I might actually, I was immediately convinced that I wouldn't listen to it as a kind of adolescent protest with arriving in the first place. Because it was an invasion. It was like somebody put a leaflet through your door, wasn't it? I didn't ask for this.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So I've bought a new CD player. I'm so excited. Because my old one was just getting a little bit shaky and wasn't queuing up quite as accurately and reliably as it might have done. Yeah, I probably had it 20 years or something. And so you're thinking, can I get a CD player? But so I did. I went to Richer Sounds. I give them a plug because they were terribly nice. And I didn't get a discount or anything. I'm not saying that because I got a discount. They were just very polite and helpful. Anyway, I bought a new CD player, rigged it up. I've got some new leads for the speakers and so forth. So it sounds a bit better. And so you kind of think to yourself, I've got to start all over again with my CDs. I've got a lot of CDs, Mark. I've probably got more CDs.
When you say start again, so in what order?
But randomly? Just kind of randomly. And so what you've got to do is you know, a lot time to this. It's like everything. It's like a marriage, Mark.
Yeah.
You've got to give it time. You know, and so, you know, you may have had those occasions with your good lady wife where you said, let's go on a date night or whatever. You know, so this is a little bit like this, but you're going on a date night with
So what do you do? So you pour yourself a glass of red and...
You got to put it in the diary.
Put on something comfortable.
Slip into something comfortable, possibly... pour out a nice glass of red wine.
I can see an old Chianti bottle with a candle in it, Dave, as you
possibly
go through your CDs.
Possibly a lighter candle. and then I'm going to play a CD. And I'd probably do it completely randomly, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So my CDs are all in drawers. They're not on the shelf. So I kind of got to walk down them and look at the spines like I could do with LPs. So I have to think, okay, I'm going to pull open one of the CD drawers or whatever, and I'm going to pull stuff out. And so, you know, you're pulling out a few different kinds of things. You're pulling out things that you think to yourself, oh, I really like that. I love that record. And then you play it and you think, it's kind of all right. You know, you know, because it might be 10 years, it might be 20 years, it might be 30 years since you'd last played it.
Yeah, you loved it because it reminded you of something that was going on at the time.
Well,
or you just liked
it at the time, but you know, later on, it doesn't sound quite as good. And then there's loads of stuff that you kind of didn't even really know that you had, or you'd never concentrated on it at all. And so I've got three here in front of me,
but I
picked out in the last few days and played them. And in each case, I've thought, you know, that's really good. And the first one is this. It's Black Grape. I didn't even know I had Black Grapes.
It's great when
you're straight. Yeah. And it's, you know, I put it on as I was working. There's a kind of certain kind of music that I put on when I'm standing up. And there's a certain kind of music I put on when I'm sitting down. And when I work, I tend to work standing up. And so kind of an up-tempo rhythmic
up-tempo,
music.
Up-tempo, sustaining, accelerated. Yeah.
And so that, I mean, how old is that record, Mike? I'll tell you how old it is.
Well, it would have come out in 95.
Okay. So that is 26, big top 20 years ago.
Yeah, right?
Yes, dude, 26, big top 20 years ago. That's a long time ago. So I like that. And I also pulled out this, which I knew I had, but I hadn't played it for a while, which is James Brown's The Payback.
Oh, right.
And actually, here's my thing with James Brown. I realize the only problem with James Brown records is James Brown. You know, if James...
Well,
in the sense that what you really want to listen to is the JBs. What you want to listen to is the extraordinary grooves. Absolutely amazing playing of the JBs and the sound that nobody else on God's earth has been able to make before or since, you know, just it simply disappeared from the earth. And so the only drawback is when James occasionally kind of tries to sing. You think, hey, James, no, just stop that. Go over there. Let the band play. And you can just be in the background and it's going to kind of issue distant exhortations to them to kind of keep doing it, you know, all that. That's fine, you know, but just don't try and come up the front. But anyway, I like that. But the biggest surprise I had in the last week, and I pulled out a few CDs by this guy, all of which I thought I liked and played them, and they didn't do it for me, but this one did. This is Robert Plant's Band of Joy.
Oh, right. Yes.
Do you know this record?
Yeah.
This came out in 2010, so yeah, it's relatively wet behind the ears, this with a band, I think with Patty Griffin was in the band at the time.
Yeah.
And he does Richard Thompson's House of Cards and all sorts of things. And I played things like, do you remember he made a record with Jimmy Page called Walking into Clarksdale? I think it was called, came out on Mercury.
Yeah.
Probably in the 90s, which I sort of remember liking. And then I put it on and thought, no, this just doesn't work anymore. You know, the air, the molecules in the air have changed in the 25 or 30 years since you made this record.
That's brilliantly put.
And it just doesn't work in the same way. Whereas that really works. And I've played it about four times in the last few days. So that's what I'm recommending people to do. You know, have a date night with your record collection, whether you've got a new CD player or not. That was just my excuse, you know.
Yeah.
But the point is, you've probably got loads and loads of records that you haven't played in years.
Should I tell you something I found the other day, which I thought were really great? One is this. Do you remember this?
Oh,
Mojo by Tom
Petty. I played
Petty.
That the other day.
That's a great record. My God. Again, quite recent, came out in 2010. Yes. And I don't.
The paint's still fresh.
It is. But it's lovely. It was recorded with the original Heartbreakers, and it's done as kind of live in the studio, and it's kind of a blues record, and it's got little bits of country rock on it, and there's a sort of smell of wood smoke about the whole thing. There's lovely songs about one about Thomas Jefferson, the founding father, and his infidelities with a maid in a woodshed in the back garden.
Well, what's her name? I've forgotten. The famous woman.
Yeah, absolutely.
He had a child by. I've forgotten the name. Anyway, go on, carry on.
A lovely song about pirate coves in Santa Cruz. Some lovely lines in it. One where you talk about old girlfriends, it says, she was part of my heart, now she's just a line on my face. It's a sweet record. Another one, I know it's not a classic rock record by any stretch of imagination.
Okay. Is that the one we're on?
No, it's the one on the second album.
Is that the first one?
This is the Duckworth Lewis record. I always thought it was so funny. Even the name, the Duckworth Lewis Method, obviously a cricketing term, but it was obviously a kind of send-up of the Bachman-Turner Overdrive, wasn't it? Or McGuinness Flint or Fleetwood Mac or whatever. And that's just the lovely. It's Neil Hannon, wasn't it?
And Thomas Walsh,
that's right. And it's just that whole thing about the cricket experience, the kind of pace of a day at the Oval. You know, the song's called, you know, The Coin Toss, The Night Watchman, Rain Stops Play, The End of the Over. It's just a lovely, lovely record. So it's kind of music hall and kind of 1920s, isn't it? You know.
And it's also, it's a summer record.
It's a summer record. It reminds you of ELO, actually. It's that wonderful old school songwriting, you know, it's really good. And the last one more. I dug up is my old pal's Chicken Shack. Oh, good grief! Are you not keen? Are you?
Well, go on. Did you play it? Have you played it?
Oh yeah, it's great.
How's it sound? Which one is that?
I love it. This is the complete Blue Horizon.
Right, okay.
But I love it because I was a major old blues head, and everyone was terribly worthy and terribly kind of forthright, weren't they? Ainsley Dunbar's Retaliation and John Mayall's Blues Breakers, and everyone was terrible. It was all sort of a student-y. And there's something really funny about Chicken Shack. Do you remember the track San Jose, the old Freddie King number?
It's a Freddie King song.
It's fantastic. It's recorded live in the studio. You can hear them all shouting at each other. You can hear them all moving around in the studio when they record it. It's just brilliant. And it made me think very fondly of Stan Webb. No oil painting, I have to say.
No.
Was he Stan, a kind of golem-like creature? But it's just a great record. But this is a good game. Dave, going back
it
and
is.
Rediscovering...
Having a date night with your records, this is what I recommend. Everybody should do this sometime over the next week. And just pick something at random. And be honest with yourself. If you put it on and it's not making it, just take it off and put another one on. Because you will eventually find one that sparks something that hasn't been sparked in ages, like I found with Robert Plant's Band of Joy. And let us know what they are, you know, via the usual links. And there'll be links in the show notes accompanying this video. What else we got? More anniversaries. It was the Beatles doing Our World, was it?
Oh, yeah, it was. It was 1967.
I'm talking to the Beatles, sorry. I just seen this. Let me interrupt you. Ringo is just a BBC hot news item. Ringo's star at the age of 80 is still causing, you know, news alerts on the BBC website that he's dropped the lawsuit against a manufacturer of sex toys called Ring-O, because he was saying that they were kind of dragging his reputation through the mud. And he's obviously decided. My learned friends must have told him that the game is not worth
your
candle. Yes, absolutely.
You're drawing attention to the fact that you're making yourself look ludicrous.
But it's the idea that it's still a lead item on the BBC News site all these years later. Anyway, carry on.
It's just the 25th, which I always thought was a really significant event, and I'd forgotten it was just after the Six-Day War.
The Arab-Israeli Six-Day War?
Yeah. And
I was staying with my grandparents. My parents were away, I remember it. Anyway, carry on.
And the various...
I remember the girl I was going out with, Mark.
Oh, right, okay.
That week, I remember.
That week? Oh, I was going out with that week.
That week. No, hold on a second. Mark, I can remember the girl I was going out with that week in the summer of 1967. Let's all, just for a moment, be quiet and just let me think about it.
It's the Likely Lads again with Deirdre Birchwood, isn't it?
Oh,
Do you imagine with the imaginary girlfriend?
Oh, no, this one was not. She was not
imaginary.
Oh, not imaginary at all.
And you're back. You're back in the Zoom. Sorry,
can I just tell you about...
That's so funny.
Major events of June 1967. You know, the Arab-Israeli six-day war. The Beatles doing, Our World. Nothing's going to change our world. On satellite. And me staying with my grandparents and walking to this girl's house. Across the fields. How Thomas Hardy is that, Mark?
That is.
Across the fields.
That's so romantic.
It was a couple of miles across the fields. But, you
know. No, you wouldn't have bothered. You would have just you would have talked to each other on a WhatsApp.
Decided not to bother.
I look
back on it with fondness. Anyway, carry on.
That's fantastic. No, well, this is a bit of a step down, really, after that romantic memory. But no, it was just after the Six-Day War, wasn't it? And the Eastern Bloc countries pulled out, which I'd forgotten about. They pulled out in protest of the Western nations' response to the Six-Day War. So a lot of the countries who were going to take part in the broadcast refused to do it.
So it wasn't one world after
it
all.
It wasn't one world. Well, how very modern that is. Times have changed.
I know.
But all sorts of people were on it. I was trying to find some YouTube of them. I couldn't find any. Maria Callas was on it, representing her country. Picasso was on it.
But the only thing anybody was interested in was the Beatles.
Yeah, completely.
We're miming too, All You Need Is Love. That's what they were doing.
And also the fact that they recorded that. They finished recording it on the 19th, I think. It was broadcast. The event was the 25th. So the idea that right up to just a few days beforehand, they hadn't actually finished the song. The idea they had the confidence to think, it'll be fine.
And it was. It was.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
I'm just going to say this. There is no greater aphrodisiac in the world than people working closely together under pressure for long hours. Okay? That's all I'm going to say on the Matt Hancock business. For those who might find it...
Which is the boss-secretary equation, isn't it?
Well, I don't think it's quite as simple as that, many, many years ago, thousands of years ago, when I was young and attractive, and I used to be in plays, never a play went by without people falling into each other's arms in the cast during rehearsal. They just did it because they were spending so much time together under pressure. That's nothing compared to government and, a pandemic and so forth. So for those like Alex, who may find it strange that Matt Hancock appears to have trouble peeling women off him, that could possibly be the explanation.
We're recording this at the very moment this news has just broken.
So
fresh to all of us. We're just looking at the pictures of Hancock in a passionate clinch with the girl in question. It's sensational.
The headline possibilities for this. I can't believe it's gone so far and nobody's yet used Hancock's half hour. Mark, you were checking. Is it Deirdre Birchwood or Deirdre?
Deirdre Birchwood. We never see her, I don't think. They talk about her fondly. I think at one point,
I've got to explain what it is, first of all. The Likely Lads of blessed memory, they used to talk about a girl that they'd been to school with that they both snogged early on. And her name was Deirdre Birchwood. And so I always used to think, that's the most brilliant name because it sounds like everyone's first girlfriend. And so I've done this at dinner parties, played the Deirdre Birchwood game, okay? Tell us the name of, it applies to men and women either. It's names you can't make up.
Exactly. It's completely plausible.
First girl that I ever got involved in a clinch with during a game of Postman's Knock at the age of about 14 was Jane Spurrier. I defy you to make up a name like Jane Spurrier. It can't be done. Who was
Jane, if you're listening?
I very much doubt. I'm sure she got better things to do. Mark, who was yours?
Mine was. Well, you're absolutely. This proves the theory. Penny Cotter.
There you go. Penny Cotter.
What a lovely name.
Alex, the Deirdre Birchwood game. Who was the first girl?
Well, go on. technically, my first girlfriend was when I was 8, and it was Nicola Ives, and we held hands.
That's not bad.
Okay,
and
good.
Hugged each other, and it was lovely.
What about an open mouth kiss? Come on.
That was Amy Collins. Amy Collins after the first term school disco in year 7. Mrs. Green caught us.
Hey.
She's still recovering now.
Very good.
Were there any repercussions? Was the punishment? No.
No punishment, no. Just a stern look. And Alex Gold! Put her down.
Started to open.
Very good. I suppose Postman Knock had long gone away by the time you got there, Alex. We used to have to find our thrills wherever we could.
We used to play Spin the Bottle.
Oh, well, there. Oh, it's very similar.
Well, that's the same sort of thing, really.
Very similar. Only after they played Spin the Bottle, they had full sexual intercourse.
Yeah. We had a kind of embarrassed peck on the cheek.
Oh, no, it was a bit more torrid than that in Yorkshire, Mark. We wouldn't have settled for that. It was, that was Hampshire, peck in the cheek. It was a lot more serious than that in Yorkshire.
Handshake.
It's a long game.
Handshake. It's like, really good.
Have you read any good books recently? No. Hampshire wasn't that innocent. But I can still remember the summer that the hot pants arrived. Oh, my Lord.
71.
71. What's 71?
71 is the year of the hot pant.
Yeah.
71 is the year of Jane Fonda in Clute, which was popularized the hot pant. And it's a combination of the hot pant with the maxi coat.
Yes, it was
the long coat, the long kind of Julie Christie and Dolce Vargo coat, and then the incredibly abbreviated.
I think it might have been the year there was a picture of Linda Ronstadt wearing this particular fashion accessory, from which I've never recovered.
No.
Oh, my Lord.
Well, that's what's known as the Daisy Dukes, isn't it, nowadays? As in Daisy Duke from the Dukes of Hazzard. Who was the glamour in the Dukes of Hazzard, who always wore those kind of cut-off Linda Ronstadt shorts. You're talking about Linda Ronstadt on the cover of, I think the album's called Hand Sewn Homegrown. Where
I
she's
think it was.
Sitting. She's sitting. Where is she sitting, Mark? Where is she sitting?
Is it in a barn?
No, it's more agricultural than that. She's sitting in a pigsty, I think.
It's a pigsty. It's a pigsty. I wasn't far off. She's on a farm, isn't she? That's right.
On an actual farm. With actual pigs.
Yes.
No wonder.
There's a great picture of her with Mick Jagger. She's backstage somewhere, and Mick Jagger's just looking at her, and she's got the hot pants on, and Mick Jagger has just absolutely just gone to pieces. And understandably, he's only human.
Absolutely. So, questions from the Massive, of which we've had a number. And Jack wants to know, has the Super Deluxe box set jumped the shark with the mega expensive All Things Must Pass? And it's Ludicrous Garden Gnomes. Do you know about this, Mark?
And I don't think it has. I don't agree with this idea that these things can jump the shark. The whole point about a box set is that if people are prepared to pay the money, let them pay the money. What's wrong with it? You're not exploiting anybody. Just say, if you don't want to buy it, don't buy it. It is, Dave, $998.98. And you get I'm looking at a little thing here. So you get a toy box-sized wooden crate that includes the album and dozens of demos and outtakes, a pile of vinyl CDs, books, and miniature facsimiles of the garden gnomes depicted on the cover, which I think is fantastic. I love that. I love it. Why not? Who wouldn't want little miniature garden gnomes?
Have you put your order in?
I'm not going the full $998, no, but I think it has every right to be there and to be on the market, and good for that.
Okay.
Brilliant.
Simon Benson says, noting the Joe Meek blue plaque, which is presumably in Holloway Road, is it? Because that's where Joe Meek used to live, breathe, and have his being. Who in the musical Firmament? Is it Firmament? It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It is long overdue, this recognition. So, if you could place one rock plaque, what would it be?
Olympic Studios in Barnes, around the corner from here, ought to have one. But you mean for an individual?
Well, it could be either a person or an individual.
Olympic Studios deserves one. It really does.
That's true.
Yeah, so much happened there.
What about you, Alex? Go on.
I would have it done for Lee Movers.
Oh, the Lars.
Yeah, I would.
What, on his house?
Yeah, and the house he probably still lives in now, because I think he lives quite a sort of humble lifestyle on a 40,000 million quid he's made of it as you go. he's a kind of forgotten genius. I think I genuinely think that genius is applicable to Lee Movers, and you know, he's only made one record, and it was really good. So he's technically never made a bad record.
Well, lot to be said for that.
So Nick Drake made one record thing. And has pretty much retired on the proceeds. He has.
Yeah, pretty much. The Lars only made one album. He hated it, and he decided never to make a record again. He's been dining out on There She Goes for what, nearly 40 years now. Fair play to him. But
good for him.
He's brilliant, and you know, I think he inspired an awful lot of people, and I think that's merit enough.
Can I tell you where I think they should put blue plaques? They should put one on either side of the street. This is something we were talking about this morning. Should have a blue plaque at 52 to 55 Carnaby Street, where the Smash Hits office was.
Yeah, there is one.
Well, there's a Don Arden.
It's about Don Arden and the Small Faces.
And then you should have a blue plaque right across the road where the NME office was.
Yeah.
Because you could, you know, loads of people worked there one way or another.
Yeah.
You know, and spent incredible formative years there. That's what I would do. That's my suggestion.
Smash It's brilliant idea.
So, Billy Edwards, I suppose this is addressed to me. Second best year for music, ? He asked. Well, you know, I don't really say 1971 is the best year for music. I say it's the annus mirabilis of the rock album. And I think 1965 was the annus mirabilis of the 7-inch 45. So that's my answer to that. 1971.
66 a good year, surely. Pet Sounds, Revolver, Small Faces, Mamas and Papas.
Can I
Jack Orion by Bert Yeancz, Tim Buckley, first Hendrix single, Miles High. I mean, we could go around in circles, couldn't we?
Can I throw 2001 into the ring? Can I?
You can. You can. Go on.
2001 had The Strokes, Is This It? Had the first Gorillaz album, had Discovery by Daft Punk, it had JZ's The Blueprint, it had Jay-Z was his English.
That's so English.
Jay-Z's a movie. Had Weezer's The Green album. I had System of a Down's Toxicity. There was an awful lot of stuff happening in an awful lot of different kinds of musical places.
Okay. And,
that's good. That's very plausible.
Good, good. It's also the year that the iPod appeared, isn't it? For the first time. It's very, very, which was quite significant.
Majorly significant.
And
was there a question about film soundtracks or TV soundtracks? Paul Connell was that?
Oh, go on, come on. I haven't got it in front of me. Go on.
It's really good. He said, what was the best use of pop and rock music in film and TV? He said, I'd go for the Kinks, Living on a Thin Line in the Sopranos episode. That's a good question, isn't it? I'll try to remember some of those. And I think there's one really unfashionable one, which is in High Fidelity, where the film really takes off, when the Jack Black character tears Barry's cassette out of the machine, throws it at him, and sticks on Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves. Do you remember that? And the whole film just lifts. And there's a lovely long shot of, I think it's Ray Liotta in Goodfellas, going to the Copacabana Club. Very sinister. And you don't know, he's going to meet, I think, Joe Pesci and Robert.
Are they going through the kitchen?
And they go through the kitchen, and there's a really long shot, about three minutes. It's The Crystals, and then he kissed me. That's fantastic.
Is that The Crystals in that?
I think so.
Woodface says, why are people so fascinated by unreleased music or different takes? It always disappoints. It does. You're completely right. Completely
it does, right. But that's not. But you're not going to just replace the version you have on your iTunes with whatever they've given you, because it's never as good. It's just, you're only going to hear it once, aren't you? It's just looking at a sketch. It's like when you see X-rays, what was under the picture, or the famous painting by Van Gogh or whatever. I don't think that. I think he's thinking that, you know, that people would want to play this more than once. They wouldn't.
No, sure. So that's your questions answered. Thank you very much. Our usual excellent service. Alex, what's this with the Foo Fighters?
Well, they've reformed, recoagulated themselves into a disco group called the DGs. And they've recorded an album called, wait for it, Hail Satin. That contains various BG covers, Dave Grohl singing in the falsetto, and it's got the greatest press shot of all time, of them all having walked off a private flight wearing linen shirts, aviator shades, little champers in their hands. It's wonderful.
Little disco shoes. It's so well observed. It's shirts slashed to the waist.
Every little medallion is in there. It's absolutely wonderful. And it's being released on Record Store Day. So it's clearly...
I love that group.
They ought to call it, they ought to call it the Great Satin.
It's also just so interesting that the Bee Gees, which were a laughing stock at one point, now kind of revered. And quite a few people, Phil Collins, ABBA. I'm trying to think of other examples.
Well, yeah. Noel Gallagher's latest record is that the cover of Noel Gallagher's latest record is another open homage, shall we say, to a Bee Gees record. And he's been talking about an awful lot recently.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a huge fan.
Which Bee Gees record is it a homage to?
I can't remember which one it is. I'll have to have a look.
Okay. I'll have to look at that. So you were talking about Record Store Day. The other thing that's happening on Record Store Day, which is, if anything, bigger,
is
a word in your park, which is on the 17th of July, which is a Saturday. This Saturday afternoon starts at 2 o'clock in Holland Park, in a very lovely custom designed covered auditorium.
Weatherproof
and also COVID safe. So it's been redesigned to ensure social distancing. And we're delighted to say that on that day, we'll be joined by...
So what a lineup. It's a great lineup. Gary Crowley.
Shy retiring, will we ever winkle anything out of them, people, as Gary Crowley, Leslie Ann Jones, Barney Hoskins, Danny, will he ever say a word, Baker. And now we're thrilled that we can add Mark Lewison, world's greatest Beatles expert. So
that is a lineup, isn't it?
If you haven't, tickets are going fast. So, you know, if you haven't already got yours, get them soon. How should people do that, Alex?
We'll post the link in the show notes. Also, you can go to wiyelondon.com and there is a handy ticket widget on the front page of the website.
And if you haven't signed up to be a Patreon, why the hell not?
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.